Okay, let's now enjoy Jamie's lovely prelude.
Hello? Hello? The first piece I'll be playing is a toccata from Buxtehude.
Kia ora and talofa. Welcome all, church whānau and visitors, to this place of worship, virtual and physical, made sacred by Auckland Unitarians for 122 years. Welcome to those joining us remotely, to those here in the building, and to those watching the recording at a later time. For those here in person, you're all invited to join us for a cup of coffee or tea immediately following our service. It is our sacrament of hospitality. Guests, visitors, and people here for the first time are especially welcome. My name is Paul Henricus, and I'll be leading our service today. For my opening words, I would like to share a traditional Samoan folk song. It's about Samoa's struggle for independence, and it's sung by mezzo-soprano Alicia Fai Holton, baritone Joel Amosa, and it's accompanied on the piano by Ludwig Treviranus, and the three of them arranged it together. So we'll now light the chalice, and Chris is going to light the chalice while I read the lightning opening. Every endeavor begins with a first step and encounters darkness and difficulty along the way. We light this chalice in anticipation of knowing the dawning of the light, the beginnings of hope, and the renewal of life. So if we can now please join in and recite the covenant of our congregation. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is the sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve humankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony, thus to be covenant with each other and with our God. Okay, so now I'll begin my talk. Now, as many of you know, with Auckland Unitarian Church support, I initiated a pilot program to help dyslexic children in Samoa in a joint program with their Ministry of Education, Science and Culture. While there, I came across information on Samoa's non-violent struggle for independence from New Zealand. And while back in New Zealand, I began to read up on the subject, and asking friends and family about it, found few knew much about it and some nothing whatever. I find it a very sad but interesting story that certainly deserves knowing about, and thought I would share a bit of it with you this morning. Before the outbreak of the First World War, Germany controlled Western Samoa, now of course called Samoa, under the Samoa Tripartite Convention of 1899, when Britain, Germany, and the United States agreed that Germany would acquire the Western Islands, including the main islands of Savai'i and Upolu, and the United States the Eastern Islands. Samoans were not consulted about this agreement at all. At the beginning of the First World War, Britain requested New Zealand seize control of Western Samoa. Germany had a radio transmitter above Apia and Samoa's current capital and largest city. And Britain believed it could be used to assist Germany's war efforts. In fact, it could send signals all the way to Berlin. New Zealand sent an expeditionary force which landed and seized control without any opposition. New Zealand continued to occupy the islands throughout the war and immediately after. Formal control came in 1920, when the League of Nations allocated the islands making up Western Samoa to New Zealand. On the 7th of November 1918, just 4 days before Germany signed the armistice ending World War I, the New Zealand passenger and cargo steamship Talun arrived in Apia from New Zealand. And Rachel, if you can just show the first... Thanks, Rachel. At the time, Spanish flu was spreading rapidly in New Zealand and it caused many deaths. In Apia, Talun was not quarantined, and although apparently some on board had Spanish flu, passengers were allowed to disembark. Influenza spread quickly, at first in the main city of Upolu and then throughout all of Western Samoa. Thanks, Rachel. New Zealand History, a website from the New Zealand Ministry of Culture and Heritage, has the following to say about the resulting disaster. Full references for my talk, by the way, will be in the text of my talk to be posted on our Auckland Unitarian Church website. So this is what New Zealand History had to say, the website. The disease spread rapidly through the islands. Samoa's disorganized local health facilities and traumatized inhabitants were unable to cope with the magnitude of the disaster, and the death toll rose with terrifying speed. Grieving families had no time to carry out traditional ceremonies for their loved ones. Bodies were wrapped in mats and collected by trucks for burial in mass graves. The total number of deaths attributable to influenza was later estimated at 8,500, 22% of the population. According to a 1947 United Nations report, it was one of the most disastrous epidemics recorded anywhere in the world during the present century, as far as the proportion of deaths to population is concerned, in other words, 22% of the population. Survivors blamed the New Zealand administrator, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Logan, for failing to quarantine the steamship Talun and for rejecting an offer of medical assistance from American Samoa. A royal commission called to inquire into the allegations found evidence of administrative neglect and poor judgment. Logan seemed unable to comprehend the depth of feeling against him and his administration. He left Samoa in early 1919 and did not return. His successor, Colonel R.W. Tait, was faced with immense grief and ongoing resentment. The influenza pandemic had a significant impact on New Zealand's administration of Samoa. Many older Matai, Samoan word for chiefs, died, making way for new leaders more familiar with European ways. For survivors, the incident was seared into memory. It became the foundation upon which other grievances against the New Zealand authorities would be built. In addition, there are many other sources other than the New Zealand History website that paint a similarly grim picture of events. Western Samoans felt particularly grieved because an American Samoa, not far away and having many family and personal ties, the governor there initiated a strict quarantine policy and the territory suffered no influenza deaths whatsoever. Following the Spanish flu epidemic, New Zealand, similar to most colonial partners, governed Western Samoa in a paternalistic and authoritarian manner. Local customs were interfered with, sometimes even prohibited. In 1922, Matai, the traditional chiefs in the villages, came under a local law giving New Zealand officials the authority to remove their titles as well as banish them. These infringements on indigenous identity were resented as much as the colonial mismanagement. Irritation was also rising among many local Europeans and those of mixed race who objected especially to the inadequate political representation. Continuing frustration led to the formation of the Mau movement by Olaf Frederick Nelson, who had a Swedish father and a Samoan mother and was well respected in both the Samoan and European communities. Many consider the Mau movement that Nelson started was to a degree a renewal of the Mau Apule formed in 1908 when Western Samoa was under German control. Mau means opinion and Pule was the name given to a group of influential orator groups on Savai'i. This movement was led by an orator chief from Savai'i and centered on the Matai or chiefs being aggrieved by the German governor's moves to alter the Samoan way of life and to centralize power in German hands. Unfortunately for Samoans, in 1909, the German administrators suppressed the Mau Apule and exiled its 10 leaders and their families to the island of Saipan, just north of Guam. The story of Olaf Nelson's renewal of the Mau movement, including the powerful role and lasting legacy of Tupua Tomasese III, has been well summarized by Archives New Zealand. And this reads as follows. An influential Samoan nationalist and businessman, Nelson visited Wellington in 1926 to voice his grievances with the New Zealand government's efforts to control Samoa's copper market and the poor treatment of Samoans under colonial rule. When his complaints received no response, Nelson founded the second iteration of the Mau at his offices in Apia with the slogan Samoa Mo Samoa, Samoa for Samoans. This time, resistance made the Mau stronger. District councils and committees established by the administration were ignored. Children were pulled from government schools, laborers stopped going to work in the coconut and banana plantations, and instead of paying taxes, Samoans gave money to the Mau. This intensified official disapproval. And in January 1928, Nelson was deported from Samoa to New Zealand for 5 years, where he continued to push the Mau's cause through mass meetings and the establishment of the New Zealand Samoa Guardian newspaper. After returning to Samoa in 1933, Nelson was exiled again the next year for 10 years, though his exile was later revoked. Meanwhile in Samoa, the Mau were intensifying their campaign under the leadership of Tupua Tomasese, that's who the song was about. It remained peaceful. European businesses were boycotted. Mau members turned themselves into the police en masse to overwhelm the prison system. The New Zealand administration responded with force, bringing in Royal Naval warships manned with Marines to enforce laws banning Mau activities. After two violent confrontations between the police and the Mau in 1928, Tomasese was arrested for non-payment of taxes and imprisoned for 6 months. The violence reached its peak on the morning of 28 December 1929, called Black Saturday, when Mau supporters, led by Tomasese, marched on Apia to welcome two Mau members who were returning from exile. As the peaceful crowd neared the courthouse, New Zealand police attempted arrests, which the Mau resisted. The police were forced to retreat and fighting broke out, resulting in the death of a constable. Panicked, New Zealand police fired rifles into the crowd, wounding 30 Samoans and killing 11. including Tomasese, who was trying to restrain the crowd when he was shot. And Rachel, if you could just show photo two, please. So that's a photo of the parade. As you can see at that time, certainly looking fairly peaceful. Okay, thanks, Rachel. Now, a number of other authors' references on the shooting of Tomasese paint a vivid and tragic picture of Tomasese standing with his back to the New Zealand police, with outstretched arms and calling peace, peace, in an attempt to stop the protesters. And then he was just shot in the back because his back was to the police. Tomasese was taken to hospital, but sadly died the next day. Before he died, knowing that his death could start a war between Samoans and the New Zealand colonial forces, Tomasese requested of his followers that peace be maintained, but that passive resistance and civil disobedience be continued. His final words were, "My blood has been spilt for Samoa. I am proud to give it. Do not dream of avenging it, as it was spilt in peace. If I die, peace must be maintained at any price." So, Rachel, you could show the photo three, thanks. So, this is Tomasese lying in state. He's surrounded by Mao leaders and supporters, including his wife. She's sitting next to him, and his son. He's got folded arms. I don't know how well you can see it. Folded arms next to the man in the sling. He was later to become the leader of Samoa when it gained independence. Also shown are two European Mao supporters, Alfred Skelton and Alfred Smith. Thanks, Rachel. The online social change library, in an article by Ian Murray, describes events following Tomasese's death as follows. Following the massacre, male Mao members fled to the mountains, the traditional retreat of those defeated in war. The resistance continued by other means, with the emergence of a women's Mao to continue the council, parades, and symbolic protests that the men now could not do. For the women's movement, even the game of cricket represented an act of defiance, inviting official harassment. A truce was declared in 1930, and the male Mao members returned to their homes as the conditions that they retained their right to engage in non-cooperation. Meanwhile, Nelson and other exiled leaders continued to lobby the New Zealand government and communicate their progress to the Mao. In other words, you know, to continue the nonviolence. In 1931, news of the growing resistance to the British rule of India reached many Samoan villages. The Mao movement had not gone unnoticed by the population of New Zealand, and the treatment of Samoans at the hands of the administration had become a contentious issue in some New Zealand electorates during the 1929 election. 1936 marked a turning point for Samoa, with the election of a Labour government in New Zealand and the subsequent relaxation of repression by the Samoan administration. Under the New Zealand government, there was slow movement towards greater involvement of Samoans in the administration of their own country. And Rachel, if you could just show the final photo, please. So this, want to show this picture just to emphasize that the Mao women were especially active in the whole nonviolent movement, taking over from the men when they went into the bush. This photo shows Mrs. Tomasese. She's the second one from your left, and then the third from your left is Mrs. Nelson. Okay, thanks, Rachel. So it wasn't until 1962 that Samoa finally obtained its independence, and it wasn't until 2002 that Samoa received an apology from the New Zealand government, an apology long, long overdue. So Jamie's now going to play some special music before we have our closing song.
The second piece I'll be playing is from Mendelssohn's Sonata No. 6, Finale.
Jamie, that was lovely. Okay, well now, if you could please join with me as we say the words for extinguishing the chalice. Just wait till they get posted. There they are. Okay, so we extinguish the
Sorry, I didn't see that, Chris.
You want to do two of them, and I'll do two. Well, for my closing words, I would like to read a quote written in 1930 by Samoan women of the Mau movement who were petitioning the New Zealand colonial administrator of Western Samoa. We are a peace-loving people and law-abiding people who gave up warlike ways over 30 years ago. We have been schooled in religion and in the arts of reading and writing for a period of just 100 years, but we love our country, our own people, our own civilization, and our own social and political systems better than any others less known to us. We are a passive people, but we are a determined and resolute people. So now if we could have the postlude, please.
The postlude will be from the first piece that I played by Buxter Hood, and it's the fugue from the Toccata and Fugue.
Okay, for small group discussion, I'm suggesting two topics. The first is, what social issues are important enough to you that you would be willing to become involved in nonviolent action to bring about positive change? And the second one is, have you taken nonviolent protest actions in the past, and what actions would you be willing to take in the future?